Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Push Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody.
My name is Sydney. I am a labor and delivery nurse and online educator in the birth postpartum world.
I'm Megan. I'm an OBGYN clinical researcher and currently suffering from my first toddler plague, if you can't hear it in my voice.
You know what? I didn't even notice that bad before.
It's getting better. I will say it's getting better. Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
Is that
when I handed over after a night shift a few nights ago and got some raised eyebrows as I was like trying to creak out my handover. But
Oh no.
Finally getting better. But all of the toddler parents out there, I get it. This is, you know, we got hit pretty hard by whatever this toddler flu is.
Yeah. So we're filming this the day after Halloween. So did you guys end up going out trick-or-treating even though you were sick? Or what did you guys do?
We hit a few houses just on our block, just of our neighbors, just to say hello and show them Sammy and his costume.
Yeah. And what was Sammy for Halloween this year?
We did a family costume. We wore green eggs and ham. So Sam was.
Wait, you didn't send me pictures. You need to send me pictures.
Sam was Sam I Am. And aww. Steve was the like grumpy old man who doesn't want to eat green eggs and ham. And then I was both the ham and green eggs.
Oh my goodness. You need to send me pictures.
I'll send you some pictures for sure.
Okay. And you guys.
I can't help but notice that you are dressed up right now too for anybody who's watching us.
I was saying I feel like a sports podcaster right now. Like I literally feel like I need to be on Jason Kelsey's podcast or some kind of male podcast right now because I am wearing the Blue Jays attire because the Blue Jays are playing game 7 tonight. So I'm a bandwagoner. I'm going to be repping my Blue Jays in LA today because they need more Blue Jays fans right now. Here, so.
Well, I feel like that's a dramatic place. It's very safe to go outside in your Blue Jays wear in Toronto right now, where I am. It's the norm, in fact, to see Jays hats and jerseys everywhere. But
not here.
A little bit alone in LA, I think, Sid.
I know. I went to the farmer's market this morning and I was wearing my Blue Jays cap. And I told Dan, I was like, you need to put on your Blue Jays shirt. And he was like, I'm not doing it. I can't do it. He's like, I'm just asking for someone to get angry at me. And I'm like, no, you're right. But actually, I didn't have anyone say anything, but I did see a lot of Dodgers shirt, caps and shirts and everything as well. So, but I just thought this was so...
For your hat?
Honestly, no. Like, not that I could tell, but I was probably just keeping my head low, but I had to match it because look at these Garmalade scrubs. They go literally so perfectly with the hat. I had to wear it. I had to do this whole fit right now.
Well, you guys have heard us wax on lots about the Garmalade scrubs. Sydney and I both love Garmalade scrubs. It really is not just hype, at least from where I sit. I have found them super comfy and really lightweight and flexible, I find too. Some of my other scrubs I feel like are a little bit stiffer. They feel a little bit heavier, especially after a long clinic day. And so we have a special surprise for you guys. Whether you are watching the Jays game tonight and want to match like Sydney is in your workwear, or whether you're just, you know, going about your usual clinic day or call shift, if you go to Garmalade and use the code thepushpodcast10, you can actually get 10% off of your next order.
Yeah. So go check it out. I really love them. I love also that they're a Canadian company. We need more Canadian brands to support right now.
Push Podcast, the Push Podcast 10. Use it at checkout. Let us know if you like the scrubs as much as we do.
Yes, we love them.
But without further ado, I'm sure that everyone would just like us to get into part 2 of our induction episode because we've gotten lots of great feedback from it, lots of great engagement already.
Oh, yes. You guys have loved the part 1 where we talked about everything that you need to know about cervical ripening, which is that first stage of the induction process. That's like before we even begin to really induce you, that's like prepping your cervix, getting it thinned out and ready to for the next step, which is what we're going to be talking about today. So if you haven't watched part 1, I would suggest go back, watch that one first and then come back to this episode, because it'll make a lot more sense if you have that background knowledge of what happens before we actually begin your induction. So go give that a listen if you haven't already. It was last week's episode. So yeah, and I feel like there was a lot of good info in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think where we've left it is we have undertaken cervical ripening, right? So we've used either a mechanical method like a Foley or Cook's balloon, or we've used a prostaglandin-based method to soften that cervix, to break down the collagen crosslinks within it so that it can start to open up and thin out and ultimately become what we would call more ripe. Yeah. So typically around the time that the cervix would have a Bishop score of greater than or equal to 6, or honestly, more practically, that it's about 3 to 4 centimeters dilated. We've started to achieve some thinning out of the cervix and it's feeling a little bit more soft and stretchy than previously. Mm-hmm. That is when we usually advocate for moving on to the next step of an induction, which is really the active induction process.
So in today's episode, we're going to be talking about, you know, what most of you have probably heard about before, which is oxytocin or Pitocin. We're going to get into that because that is largely involved with an induction usually for most people, as well as artificial rupture of membranes. So instead of your water breaking on your own, we break your water artificially. So we're going to get into all of that, what the evidence says, the outcomes, and then patient experiences as well with inductions. So
all right. So for this stage of the induction, by this point, you have been admitted to hospital invariably because we cannot administer oxytocin or break your water without having somebody be admitted to hospital. So you are in your birthing suite, your birthing partner is there, you have all of your things. Usually you have an IV at this point, and Sydney can talk a little bit more about like the preparation process for this next step. And we are getting ready to move forward with this again, next stage of the induction process. The most common medication that we use once we've achieved adequate like ripening of the cervix is oxytocin. And as Sydney mentioned, oxytocin is something that a lot of people have heard about. In Canada, it's also called Pitocin. And I think in the US also Syntocin is the synthetic form. And basically, it's just a copy of what your body is already making. So I often tell patients we're not terribly original oftentimes in obstetrical medicine. Many of the medications that we use, particularly to help guide patients through labor, are actually just synthetic versions of what your body and your brain would already make.
Exactly.
So oxytocin is one of the main hormones that kicks your uterus into gear. How it works is that it binds to actually special receptors on the uterus. And what's interesting is that those receptors actually multiply significantly the closer somebody gets to term. And we consider term to be 37 weeks. So once people have reached term, we expect them to have a lot more oxytocin receptors than they would have had earlier in their pregnancy. Once oxytocin locks in, it basically opens up a channel so that calcium can flood into the cells of the muscle wall of the uterus. And that allows them to contract. It also nudges your body to produce more of those prostaglandins that we talked about earlier. And again, those are going to allow your cervix to continue to soften and open. And they also help to work in conjunction with your muscle cells to make those contractions more coordinated and oftentimes stronger. So when we give oxytocin in the context of an induction of labor, we give it in an IV, and we usually start it at, we do a continuous dose of oxytocin. We start it very low and then we increase it slowly over time within an established protocol that we've looked at and found to be safe at that rate. Basically to allow or to try to mimic the way that your body would release more and more oxytocin as a more active labor process progresses. There are a bunch of different protocols that we can use, high dose protocols, low dose protocols. Many of them are considered to be safe, and which one we choose really depends on the individual patient circumstances and the circumstances that the baby is involved in as well. So Sydney, though, you are really the expert of setting up for oxytocin. Why don't you walk our listeners through what it looks like when you reach that hospital room and how we even start to administer this?
Yeah, so once you're actually admitted to hospital, so let's say you've had either the Foley or the Cervidil put in, you went home, you came back, which for some people they do stay in hospital as well. We talk about that in part one. But let's just say you come back, we get you fully admitted. So we go over all of your paperwork, all of your admission paperwork, which can take some time. That's kind of the not fun part. But we get through all of that. We ask you a bunch of questions about your pregnancy, about your allergies, about your medications you're taking, all that kind of stuff that I'm sure you've been asked a million times throughout your pregnancy. But we just make sure we have everything up to date. And then after that, we do what, as Megan mentioned previously, an IV. So with oxytocin, it's kind of a non-negotiable. It goes through intravenously. So it's not something that we can offer you as a pill that you take orally or something like that. It has to go through the IV. And that's just it's also how we can titrate it and monitor it very closely. Yeah, it's actually safer that way. So we have to do the IV, and usually with the IV, we'll draw your blood work at the same time that we insert the IV, which is handy because then you don't need to be poked multiple times, hopefully, unless you have skinny, scrawny little veins that are causing us trouble. But usually most labor and delivery nurses, I feel like, are pretty good at
You guys are pretty good
getting
at getting an IV.
yeah, we're pretty good. We insert a lot of IVs. So it's one of my favorite things to do, actually. I love IVs in a weird way. I don't
Your
like
sister's so
in
much better at it than us. Do you know I was told once that a protocol at a certain hospital was to call the resident if the nurse couldn't get the IV?
No, you
She's
don't
like,
want
"No,
the
you
resident
don't want
doing
me to try
it.
your IV."
No, exactly. You do not want that. I mean, I obviously don't enjoy doing them because I know they're painful for the patient, but I like to be able to do it in my goal is always to do it in the least painful way possible. Like when someone says, "Oh, I barely felt that," I'm like, "I did my job properly," you know? So, and we try to put it in a spot that's not going to be irritating. So I personally hate IVs in the hand. I just feel like it gets in the way, and like when you're laboring, it gets really like your hands can get sweaty, and usually they have a higher chance of falling out if they're in your hand. But some people still do insert them in the hand, and I've had patients ask if they can have it in the hand versus like in your forearm. So personal preference for sure, but I prefer to do the forearm just because it's a little bit more out of the way and not in like a spot where you're going to be bending your arm, like your AC, which is where they take your blood work when you go get your blood work taken. We don't want to do it there because when you're pushing and stuff, it's going to get in the way, and it's going to get occluded, and we want that medication to be constantly flowing. So anyways, that's a lot about IVs, but once we get your IV inserted, that's when we also want to be monitoring baby. So before we actually even start oxytocin, we're monitoring baby for a minimum of 20 minutes just to make, or it's, well, once we put you on the monitor, it's about 20 minutes just to make sure we get a good fetal heart rate tracing and making sure baby's doing well. And usually that's one of the things that we do first once you arrive at the hospital anyway. So that might be done before you even get the IV. It's one of those things, one or the other, might all happen at the same time. But yeah, and then once we get our heart rate tracing on baby, we know baby's doing well. We will continuously fetal monitor you with oxytocin. So that's a part of our protocol. We want to make sure baby's doing well, and we want to be monitoring your contraction pattern as well. So that's how we know how to titrate the medication and if we should increase it, if we should decrease it, if we should stop it. So it, you guys may have heard in other videos that we or other podcast episodes we've talked about intermittent auscultation, which is when you're listening to baby every so often, only for like a minute. You're not listening continuously. And unfortunately, with oxytocin or pitocin, you can't do that. We have to be monitoring baby at all times. And usually, when you're first admitted and you're still kind of in the early phases, you're not in that active labor phase yet. A lot of my patients like to be able to walk around still. And that's when I love to use a monitor that you can actually get up and walk around, which is called a telemetry monitor. So that one usually just hooks up to your IV pole. And then you pretty much have free range of the room at least. My telemetry monitors at my hospital, they work pretty well in the hallway too. So most hospitals will have an option that you can still get up and move. Because I think a lot of people feel like if they're hooked up to the monitor right beside the bed, then they can't move, right? Or you have to stay mm-hmm. close to the bed. So that's the only, I guess, downside, but there are options. So you can still get the telemetry monitor if you want to move around. And the nurse will probably be in, like, adjusting the monitor quite a bit too. That's completely normal as well.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up intermittent fetal monitoring and continuous fetal monitoring, Sydney, because I found that mm-hmm. that's something that I've had a lot of patients ask me about in the context of an induction, particularly for those for whom induction was not their original plan, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they really valued the ability to move around a little bit more and to labor in a way that was less encumbered by a lot of our monitors. Mm-hmm. So basically, the reason that continuous fetal monitoring was introduced with respect to induction of labor was in the interest, as we've kind of alluded to, of detecting things like low oxygen to baby mm-hmm. And distress for baby and guiding timely intervention, right? So that we can, excuse me, guys, so that we can identify these things early and intervene in enough time to change outcomes, right? Part of mm-hmm. the reason why it's recommended in an induction is because we are doing things that have an inherent risk of increasing the likelihood of what we would call uterine tachycystole, right? So mm-hmm. overcontracting of the uterus and subsequent fetal distress. Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at the evidence, continuous fetal monitoring with oxytocin and rupture of membranes, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute, certainly show strong evidence for decreasing the risk of neonatal seizures. Mm-hmm. So they have about half the risk of a baby having seizures, you know, in the course of, or, you know, following a delivery.
Not in utero.
No, they don't, though. Continuous monitoring, even in the context of induction, does mm-hmm. not necessarily decrease the risk of perinatal death and mm-hmm. or of outcomes like cerebral palsy. Okay. So it is a little bit of a nebulous thing that we're trying to capture, I think, with respect to how quickly can we intervene and what kind of outcomes can we actually really impact with continuous monitoring. Now, I bring that up in full transparency, not because I would recommend anything different. Certainly, it is well established within our guidelines that for low-risk patients who are not receiving things like oxytocin, intermittent auscultation is recommended, right? And it not is, shown to be any different with respect to overall outcomes than continuous monitoring. Mm-hmm. However, again, because of the inherent risks associated with an induction, mm-hmm. we do still strongly recommend continuous monitoring during that time frame. Mm-hmm. And as I was trying to kind of deep dive this a little bit more to understand a little bit better, like what does make a difference in fetal outcomes overwhelmingly, I think part and parcel of what is helpful with continuous monitoring is not just like seeing a deceleration or a drop mm-hmm. in the heart rate happen, mm-hmm. but it's also that we have a whole network of protocols associated with how to monitor labor with continuous monitoring, right? We have standardized response checklists. We have ways that we titrate the oxytocin that our nurses will either decrease oxytocin, turn it off at this point, or refuse to increase it, right?
Yeah.
Depending on what the contractions are looking like, how we're grading the fetal heart tracing. And really, I think as a discipline, that is often where we think that the actual benefit lies, right? It's not just in like having a fetal heart tracing consistently, but it's in all of the established protocols that we've studied and put into place that we feel do carry weight with respect to giving people an overall better outcome.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you did briefly mention uterine tachycystole, and I just want to mm-hmm. Simplify that, because that's one of the things that, you know, we worry about with induction and with artificially, you know, starting your labor is having too many contractions. And mm-hmm. And that's what uterine tachycystole is. It's just, we want to have time in between your contractions for your body, for your uterus to relax and for baby to get a good amount of blood flow and oxygen. Mm-hmm. So I usually kind of use the analogy that when you're having a contraction, it's almost like the baby is holding their breath in a way. So it's mm-hmm. they're built to withstand contractions.
Yes.
They're completely able to. Mm-hmm. But that being said, if you're having contractions that are A, lasting way too long, so, you know, what if you're having a contraction that's like 2 minutes long or longer, mm-hmm. or you're having contractions that are like every 15, 30 seconds you're having a contraction, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that's not giving enough rest for baby in between to just be able to take a deep breath before the next one comes. So that's one of the things that we're monitoring very closely on oxytocin to make sure that mm-hmm. we see how your body responds so that you're having a good enough contraction pattern to cause cervical dilation and cervical change, but not too many contractions that's leading to potentially, you know, fetal heart rate decelerations and stress on baby.
Totally. Now, stress on baby is something that people, I think, really worry about with respect to having an induction, right? Mm-hmm. And I think an important thing to address with that as well is kind of a few things that you've already brought up, Sid, which number one is that labor is inherently stressful to babies, right?
Yeah.
And that's whether it's oxytocin from your brain or oxytocin from an IV. Yeah. That process of creating contractions that are going to ultimately produce cervical change and then descent through the birth canal is stressful to babies. Mm-hmm. And while I don't want to scare anybody about a labor process in general, right? Because for the most part, this goes very smoothly, right? And babies, as you mentioned, are built in many ways to withstand a lot of stress during labor. I will also say that I have additionally had uterine tachycystole with no oxytocin, right? Mm-hmm. Or no oxytocin through an IV, right? There is always oxytocin in labor, to be so clear.
Yes.
Every labor has oxytocin. It is just the question of whether it's produced by your brain or whether we are giving it to you through an IV. Yes. And I have certainly, with the some of the benefit of an induction, at least as far as managing abnormal tracings, right? So abnormalities in the fetal heart tracing, is that I can control the oxytocin through an IV. We can turn it off, we can turn it down, we can tiptoe back up on it. Mm-hmm. We have a million different ways that we can run these protocols to try and, you know, get the balance of a productive contraction pattern as well as, you know, tolerability for your baby.
Yes.
But I can't turn down somebody's oxytocin that's coming from their brain, right? We have comparatively fewer interventions or you know, management strategies, I guess is probably the better word, to cope with that. So all of this is still kind of part and parcel of the same thing, right? The question is really just, is this coming through an IV or is this coming through your brain? But let's back up a step, because truly most of the time before we even turn on the oxytocin, we are moving towards breaking your water. Mm-hmm. And so this is what's called an artificial rupture of membranes or an amniotomy. And this typically happens in and around the neighborhood of starting oxytocin as we, again, enter into this true induction phase. So this active induction phase of labor. What it involves is basically a cervical exam. So similarly to what you would have had previously, where we check your cervix to see how dilated you are. But additionally, we use a small plastic, at least at our hospitals, device that we are able to insert up into the cervix and basically just catch an edge of the amniotic sac to tear a hole in it. Now, that sounds really dramatic and sounds really scary.
I'm going to go grab it.
You have one. Amazing.
I think so. Okay, you guys. I went into my bin of expired medical supplies that I take from the hospital whenever we're throwing stuff out because I feel like it's great teaching opportunity. But if you guys are watching on YouTube, you can see this is the amni hook here. And I'll show you what the actual tip looks like. So you can see here, it's like a little crochet hook. That's why we call it that, because it truly looks like one. And it's very long, but I think, Megan, you can kind of speak on this, that you don't necessarily stick this entire thing into someone's vagina and up until their uterus. It's just usually, you know,
hard to reach the amniotic sac.
Exactly. So I feel like it's usually not the entire
no length of this. I always offer to show this to my patients too, so I'm so glad that you had this with you, Sid, because it's far less of a dramatic instrument than it sounds like at the end. Like a hook sounds horrible. A hook sounds really, really scary. But this is actually like quite a gentle device, at least.
It's not sharp. Like it's truly just a little plastic crochet hook. So, But it does the job. The other thing
to note as well is that, again, it sounds really scary. And sometimes patients, often patients, I would say, are starting this process without an epidural, right? At this point, they don't necessarily always have an epidural.
Yeah.
And so I think the reassuring thing to know is that the amniotic sac doesn't have any nerves. So breaking the water in and of itself is not going to cause you additional pain, right? Like from the amniotic sac actually having that hole within it.
Yeah.
However, obviously the exam is uncomfortable, right? To say the least, and outright painful for some people. Yeah. And it is a longer exam with a little bit more traction applied to the cervix. So like a little bit more stretch so that we can actually use the amni hook appropriately and guide it through the cervix than would have been with a regular cervical check. So it's a little bit of an amped up cervical check, I would say, and absolutely can be uncomfortable and painful from that perspective. But rest assured, like we are not tearing a hole in anything that you have nerve endings to, right?
Exactly. And that's, you can kind of think of it, if your water was breaking naturally on its own, that is inherently not painful. It's the contractions that potentially follow that your water breaking, those can be painful, but the actual water breakage isn't painful. It's just a little bit of a shock because you have a big gush of fluid come out. And then same thing happens with us artificially rupturing your membranes. It's just the exam itself that can be quite uncomfortable. But I would say majority of my patients tolerate the arms pretty well, I would say.
I think so too.
Yeah.
So the way that the arm works as well, or the amniotomy rupture of membranes, is that basically when we release the amniotic fluid, the pressure differential changes in your uterus, right? And so baby's head is able to come and sit down very firmly now at that point on your cervix, which again, helps your body to release prostaglandins, to strengthen your contractions, and to allow your cervix to dilate even more efficiently than it did previously. For some people, I'm raising my hand, for people on podcasts, they may even find that things progress very intensely after breaking your water with or without oxytocin. It can be a very, like, from the perspective of it being natural in the sense that it's like your own body's hormones that are doing that, it can ramp things up pretty quickly.
For some people, it's even all that they need. Not, I would say majority, like second time moms or like patients who have had previous deliveries, usually that's those are the patients that it works for, where we don't actually have to start any artificial oxytocin. We can just do the ARM. So
Now I've seen lots of things online where people have said, you know, don't let your providers break your water, discourage, you know, frequent checks.
Wait as long as you can to get your water broken.
So listen, I will never judge somebody for, you know, having a strong personal feeling about how they want their labor to go, nor will I judge somebody on the experience of a vaginal exam, right? Because that can, as we've discussed, be really uncomfortable at best and downright painful for some people, right? Yes. I would say most people kind of fall kind of somewhere in between. But what I will say is, in the context of an induction, it is actually a really important step. So breaking your water, and breaking it actually when you would consider kind of early, right? So when the cervix is ripe at that like 4-ish centimeter mark, actually has really good evidence that it helps to speed things up. And on average, it can shorten time to delivery by an average of 5 hours. So even more for some people than if we did nothing alone. In this context, it does not increase C-section rates when the water is broken early, and there's no higher risk of things like infection or bleeding or even cord prolapse, where the umbilical cord kind of falls out before the baby does, which would also be an emergency. So it's actually supported by quite high quality evidence as a safe way to help labor progress faster. Again, no one's going to do anything to your body that you don't agree to. But I think that it is helpful to know that the things that we're suggesting are not just, you know, in service of convenience, right? It's it's because they are evidence-based in the interest of helping to assure a vaginal delivery occurs. Because the last thing we want is for people to stall and have longer labor processes in an induction, because that can we can find ourselves in situations where labor stalls, where the cervix starts to get swollen, where perhaps we have an opportunity for infection to take hold. And these are all things that we're looking to avoid if possible.
Now, what's the evidence on starting oxytocin or Pitocin first versus, and then waiting a couple hours to get that baby's head lower and to have, you know, contractions on your own before artificially rupturing the membranes, or just breaking the water artificially and then waiting a couple hours and then starting Pitocin? Like, what are your thoughts on that? What does the evidence suggest for that? And I know everyone's obviously individual and there's different care plans for everyone, but what does the evidence suggest there?
So the truth is that the evidence is mixed on that, Sydney. There's evidence to support both approaches, right? Mm-hmm. Both for administering oxytocin right away after breaking the water, administering oxytocin a little bit, you know, a couple of hours later, as well as for oxytocin and then ARM. But there isn't really consensus on which one is obviously superior. And so I think where that leaves us is in a place where care should be individualized to the patient context, right?
Yeah.
I'd say probably one of the more common reasons why we would start oxytocin first and then do the rupture of membranes is if we feel that the head is still high.
Okay.
So oftentimes we want the baby's head to be sitting down, nice and firmly on the cervix, so that it acts as kind of a plug when we're breaking the water. And if the baby's head is still kind of floating up higher in the belly, while we can certainly do controlled ruptures of membrane, which are a little bit more of a an advanced level skill where we let the water out very slowly and guide baby's head down to the cervix, usually we prefer to do it in the safest way possible, which is with the baby sitting firmly there. And so sometimes we will start the oxytocin and then wait a few hours, hoping that that oxytocin increasing contractions brings baby down a little bit lower so that we can safely perform the rupture without fear.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you for explaining that.
Oh my goodness, no problem.
It's something that keep going.
Oh,
yeah.
No, go ahead, Sid.
I was just going to say, it's something that I always wonder too, because I'm usually just assisting with whatever the doctor's plan of care kind of is. And we discuss the options with our patients ahead of time. And sometimes they're like, oh, I don't want my water broken yet. I'd prefer to just like have some contractions first. And like, if that's the case, if that's what you want to do, you know, talk to the doctor who's on call or who you're working with at the time and see what they recommend for you, because they've also performed your vaginal exam and they have more information than what we would know. So it's interesting to know, but thank you. Thanks for explaining that.
Oh my gosh, no problem. Can I ask my own question and then answer it?
Yes, of course. What is
this
it?
This one I find so interesting, and I feel like people talk about this all the time too, is that they say that oxytocin through the IV is more painful than oxytocin that is produced by your body. That is a huge one. And I think there's a lot of people, and the inclination is to say, no, it's the same because it's oxytocin no matter what. And it may just be that an induction ramps up faster and you have less time to adjust or what have you. And while there's certainly some truth to that, there is also a little bit of nuance that I find interesting as a biology geek. So oxytocin is a hormone that is produced by a region of your brain called the hypothalamus. And it is then typically sent down to a gland called the pituitary gland, or the posterior pituitary to be exact, which just kind of sits underneath your brain. And that's kind of like the holding cell for the oxytocin that's designated to go out to your body. So that's the oxytocin that's going into your bloodstream that's going to be circulated everywhere around. There isn't a dramatic difference between that oxytocin and the oxytocin that we give you through an IV. Right? Because both of them are reaching your bloodstream. Both of them are going directly to targeted organs like the uterus. There's a little bit of a difference in the pulsatility. So the oxytocin through the IV is like a low, slow, constant dose, where the oxytocin coming from your pituitary does a little bit more of a pulse. And there's some debate about whether that can impact how we feel the oxytocin. But by and large, they're largely the same. Okay. The main difference is this, and people love to talk about this thing called the blood-brain barrier, right? Which is a fairly complex a neurobiological, you know, concept.
Yeah, but I
think what is important here for with respect to that is that the oxytocin that's in the posterior pituitary, as well as the oxytocin that's going through your IV, goes to your bloodstream or goes through your bloodstream, goes to your organs, but can't come back home to your brain. Mm. However, when this process is happening naturally, your hypothalamus is also still producing oxytocin, and that oxytocin is interacting with your brain and is responsible for some of the kind of like happy effects, like the happy hormone effects of oxytocin.
Yes, which is probably how most people have heard of oxytocin before, is it's the love hormone, the happy hormone, right? Exactly. Not the hormone that's causing you to give birth. It's kind of,
And so that has an impact on stress modulation in your body, as well as the way that you perceive pain, because all pain is perceived, right? Pain is our brain's way of interpreting what is happening to our physical body.
Yeah.
And so it's less about like a literal different thing happening to the uterus, for instance. And it's more about the loss of that oxytocin that is produced in your brain when this is happening with a natural process. But the good news with an induction as well is that our body does see the circulating oxytocin given through the IV and does start producing it its own in turn. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if in the context of an induction that you totally lose that effect in and of itself.
Yeah,
completely. Your body will likely see this oxytocin and will start chiming in to help out with the induction process too.
Yeah, and you know what, guys? Let us know if you've had a delivery that was a non-induction, so you went into labor on your own, or you had an induction with Pitocin, and, you know, I would love to know someone's experience on that and if they can shed light on if they felt that it was more painful with the Pitocin versus your natural producing oxytocin. I've asked patients because I'm always curious. I do my own little studies, and I've had some people say that they felt that the induction was more painful, and then I've had other people say that their natural, I'm using quotes for that, but their natural labor was easier or harder, I should say, because it went on for a lot longer. So, okay, Megan, I have a couple questions for you that I know our listeners probably are thinking as well. So the first one is, does induction make it more likely to need a C-section? So I think that's probably everyone's biggest fear.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, I totally understand why that is. And I'm a big proponent of vaginal deliveries, of course. Mm-hmm. But let's like set aside for a second that a C-section can be a wonderful delivery. A C-section, no one should feel ashamed for wanting or choosing a C-section for any number of different reasons. And it is not indicative of failure in a delivery. A C-section is still a delivery, right? And it's comes with its own set of challenges. There's no less worthy of celebration than a successful vaginal delivery.
Absolutely.
But with that being said, and the other caveat being, I don't have a crystal ball for anybody's labor. I wish I did. Mm-hmm. Even my most straightforward, no intervention delivery can wind up needing a C-section, right? For either maternal or fetal reasons at any point. And so it's hard to say, like, for any individual person, whether, you know, anything that we do is going to increase or decrease the risk of C-section. Obviously, that would never be our goal, and anything we do would be in service of a vaginal delivery if that's what they wanted. But okay, with like 1 billion levels of caveat aside, inductions for all comers, right? So when we try to minimize all of the other factors that could weigh in, cesarean sections are actually shown to decrease slightly when we look at inductions in healthy primiparous women, so first-time deliveries beyond 39 weeks or at 39 weeks. And so in that population where we've kind of controlled for as many of the other factors as we can, right? So medical reasons why somebody might be induced, fetal reasons why somebody might be induced, we actually don't see that C-sections are increasing with induction rates. And if you haven't listened to part one already, where I really go into a lot of detail about the ARRIVE trial, then please go back and listen to that, because I do actually break down the ARRIVE trial and the subsequent studies that tried to look again at the circumstances of the ARRIVE trial and test it in repeated or in new ways. And certainly that's a finding that we've seen repeated.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Will not increase your chance. Answer is no. Yeah. And I sometimes feel like, you know, when an induction does end in a C-section, mm-hmm. there's certain signs that may be there that the C-section would have happened whether or not we induced you or not, right?
That's such a good point, right? Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. Sometimes we see through the course, like induction was just our route to trial of a vaginal delivery, right? And we were able to see through some part of that a vaginal delivery would have been very challenging in this circumstance, right?
Exactly.
And so sometimes like it's just a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy that because we found that out in the course of an induction that it was, you know, it wasn't necessarily the induction that caused it, right?
Exactly. And at the end of the day, we're, like we said previously, we're monitoring baby very, very thoroughly while you're being induced to see if there's any issues we have with fetal heart rate changes and all that kind of stuff. So we're monitoring, we're making sure baby is safe and happy and healthy in there. And if there's any reason why we need to rush to do an emergency C-section, then of course we will do that. But it doesn't inherently increase your risk for that because we're monitoring so much. We are making sure everything's good. So, and there's been years and years of protocols made and put in place for that reason. So the next question I have is, will it make my labor longer if I have an induction?
So that answer, unfortunately, usually is yes. So it does look like trying to get the process started artificially does take a little bit more time than if it were to occur spontaneously on its own. But again, I think the caveat to that as well is, well, that's certainly important to consider, right? Especially with respect to someone's experience of an induction. It's not shown to increase outcomes that are associated with prolonged labor sometimes, like C-sections.
Yeah. And I think that also takes into account that first stage that we talked about in part one, which we keep referencing.
Yeah, 100%. So much of that is the first stage, right?
So much of it is that. And I think, you know, it helps to kind of start that timer in your head once you're admitted and, you know, whether we, or once you're in that active labor. So that's having painful contractions every 2 to 3 minutes lasting a minimum of 60 seconds. So that's your active labor phase. And usually that's lasting for at least an hour before you're actually in active labor. And sometimes that can take a long time to achieve before you're in that active labor phase. So
totally. Well, and not to be like, well, this also happens outside of an induction constantly, but it also happens outside of inductions, right?
Like 100%.
How many patients have you seen in triage, Sid, who are just like really struggling through the early stages of labor for sometimes days. Right? That can be happening all on its own, prodromal labor. And
awful. I wish it didn't exist, but it exists for a lot of people, whether or not you're being induced or not.
The scope of experience of labor, both in the early stages and in the active stages, is just so wide, right?
Yeah.
That it's again, it's hard to know, especially if this is your first delivery and you're being induced. It's hard to know how much of some parts of it are, you know, wrapped up into the process of, again, trying to jumper cable this process versus how much of it is just, you know, your body's particular experience of this labor too, right? Because we see big variations sometimes in how labor can progress between pregnancies.
Every pregnancy is different. Every baby's so different, right? The other thing I wanted to mention is there's a lot online that says, you know, an induction leads to a cascade of interventions. And you guys probably hear that too for like, well, once you go to the hospital, then that's when the cascade of interventions starts. So that's why a lot of people like to labor at home and stay at home for as long as they possibly can. I would like you to kind of touch on that. What are your thoughts on that?
The cascade of intervention?
Yeah, as an OB, like how does that make you feel? Yeah.
Yeah, I have many thoughts on that, and I hope I get it right, like kind of in one like improv go now. But please, if you feel like I need to address this again, I'm happy to hop on and like amend this. But I guess my first thought is certainly I'm very supportive of people laboring at home for, you know, low risk patients who do not need us for like pain management through like epidurals or other or nitrous gas or any of the other things that we'd only be able to administer in hospital. Mm-hmm. I'm totally happy for those patients to labor at home. So first and foremost, most of us are very supportive of that, actually.
Yep.
I do think it is worth, though, a little bit of a closer look sometimes to what are we saying when we're talking about a cascade of intervention, and mm-hmm. with what intention is that statement used, right? Mm-hmm. I think what it's designed to say is like one intervention begets more interventions. But the truth is that one action in labor oftentimes begets more action in labor in general, right? Labor is by definition progressive, and any person could need different things at each kind of chapter as you go through that labor process. It worries me that it's used often, or the way that I see it used most often, is as a means to like engender distrust, I think, in the medical system, and to suggest that sometimes when we're doing things that we're not doing it for any reason at all. Most of us, I would say, at least, you know, the professionals that I'm lucky enough to work with are very thoughtful with the interventions that they do introduce to patients and that they don't, right?
Yeah.
And then the last thing I guess I'll say about the cascade of interventions is that we do know from evidence that certainly when you're with us in hospital, we are more likely to do things, right? Mm-hmm. And part of that is not nefarious. It is... Mm-hmm. Because when you're watching abnormalities in the fetal heart rate, we're oftentimes in a position where we feel that we have to take them seriously, even if we know that they're likely to be okay, right?
Yes.
The predictive value of a really good tracing, so that the fetal heart rate looking beautiful, is actually very high that everything is okay. So a really good tracing is really predictive of everything being okay.
Yeah.
A bad tracing is actually not that predictive of a bad outcome. And so when I'm teaching residents and medical students to interpret NSTs, for instance, kind of the reframing that I think that we have to take often is we're not looking for badness necessarily. We should be looking to be reassured, right? Because the predictive value of a good NST is very high.
Yes.
But when you're with us in labor and we're watching a tracing that doesn't look good, we are now in a position of saying, okay, even if there's only, and I'm making up a number because I can't remember off the top of my head the actual predictive value, but if there's a 10% chance that something bad is happening to your baby, for most people, the predictive value of that is too high, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that does put us in a position oftentimes, if even if we're sure that this baby is going to come out kicking and screaming and angry and fine, of having to act in the interest of the safest route forward. Even if it might be a little bit of an overcall in retrospect, because the truth is at the end of the day, I try to like guess, you know, use all the information I have at my disposal every single time and use all my teammates and my patients' experience and try to pull that information to make really the best decision we can make at any given point. But I would rather guess wrong and end up with a healthy baby and a healthy mom that we're just upset that we ended up having to do a vacuum or turn on oxytocin or go to a C-section, than assume that everything is fine because it probably is and have something really catastrophic happen.
Yeah. And I think this brings up a good point for everyone listening who might be going in to have an induction or just going in labor in general. Have those conversations with your care team. You know, if they're offering you something and you're not sure, or you're like, you want to know more, if this is something that is, you know, just them following a protocol that you don't necessarily think that you need, ask, what would happen if I don't do this? Or why are you recommending this? You know, have that conversation. And I'm telling you guys, the team who's on is going to walk you through why they think it's best for you. And it's important to have those conversations so that you can feel like the care that is happening for you is personalized and makes sense for you and your baby. I also wanted to just briefly touch on Pitocin augmentation. So I know we're talking about inducing labor in this episode, but augmentation is just when we would start a Pitocin drip once you've already started your own labor on your own.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to quickly mention that differentiation because I know a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people online too saying, you know, I really didn't want to be augmented with Pitocin. I didn't want them to start me on Pitocin because I was afraid of that cascade of interventions that you were mentioning. And, you know, I want to just say that it's hard to, you know, we want to say things properly here, but I have seen patients be augmented with Pitocin and when they really needed it, like I will say that it is a very powerful tool to have at your disposal while you're in labor. Sometimes labor stalls and we in modern medicine have the ability to keep your labor going so that you don't end up in a C-section. It can actually be helpful so that, you know, because at the end of the day, we're trying to get baby Earthside as safely as possible, which for most people, not everyone, but for most people is with a vaginal delivery. And if we can encourage that to happen, then we will. So augmentation and Pitocin isn't necessarily the villain. It can be very helpful in a lot of situations. I think there's potentially some, in the past, there's been maybe some misuse on Pitocin with things online I've read of people saying, you know, this is a business of having babies, right? We're just trying to get babies out quick and fast and get it done as fast as possible. Yeah. So, and you know, I can't say for sure that hasn't happened. It probably has, like realistically.
Listen, we can't speak to every provider. What I will say though, too, is that it's hard. Like I have lots of people who come in who want their baby out fast. And I have lots of people who come in, especially living in a city, you know, where we have lots of very busy people, sometimes professional athletes, sometimes, you know, all sorts of different people who may only have a small window of time sometimes for social reasons to deliver. Or as we've kind of alluded to before, may have like childcare constraints and we're trying to be efficient with an induction. Even when everyone is on board and we're like throwing everything we have to try and to, you know, get an induction moving in an efficient way, we're not always able to do that. Even with all the oxytocin in the world, you're not going to be able to frequently like really dramatically change the course of somebody's induction. What like, I think my comment on that too is birth sometimes in guiding people through a labor and delivery scenario feels like you are charting a course on a river with 1,000 tributaries. And all you know is that you want to get from point A to point B, but there are a million branches as you're sailing down. And it's hard to know exactly which one is the right path to take. You're just trying to chart the safest, most straightforward route through.
Yeah.
It's possible that if, you know, that someone could have labor that was moving a bit slowly, start oxytocin, and maybe require like an epidural, which is maybe an intervention that they didn't want because their labor increased and the oxytocin felt more intense. That's super possible. It's also possible that if we didn't start the oxytocin, that someone could have wound up with the C-section, right?
Yeah.
It's possible that we, you know, did a forceps or vacuum that would have been a C-section if we hadn't had interventions in play. And again, that's not to say that, like, I don't mean to discredit someone's experience or to make them, you know, feel that, you know, it would have certainly been worse, because the truth is we don't know. But there are a billion different things that we can do to help support somebody through a labor.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think it's, we can't know in retrospect what the other tributaries would have held. You know, the best we can do is as a team all together, pick the best path forward. And then the last thing I'll say actually on cascade of interventions too, just while we're talking about it, is I find it's also often used as this kind of like term that is meant to pit different types of providers against one another. So like midwives against OBs, against family practice OB providers. And I just have to say, in at least in my practice, and perhaps I'm just in like an incredibly privileged position in this, like that is not how I have navigated this river with these colleagues. We're often all sitting at the same nursing station asking each other casually questions about the different patients that we're taking care of. And I have I can't really even think of a time when I haven't been able to meet with a provider from a different background of my than myself and discuss a patient in a way that felt anything other than like everyone was really on the same page about trying to, you know, get this patient the experience and the delivery they want and deserve. You know, we may sometimes have different ideas about how to get there, but like usually the practice is actually not nearly as adversarial as it seems. And again, my huge caveat is I'm sure that there are a million different ways that this has gone that is not that, but yeah. I think that I would hope that the overwhelming rule is that, you know, we're actually all pretty collaborative and we all recommend interventions at different points.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I like to think of it as tools in your toolbox mm-hmm. that are available that we can choose to use, like, and we can choose not to use. And there's lots of different kinds, you know, there's a hammer, there's a drill, there's all kinds. So, but at the end of the day, like your team is there to discuss all those things with you.
Yeah.
So if you have questions, always ask them, you know, we will have time to go over those things with you and why we think one option might be better for you than another. So at the end of the day, that's the best advice we can give you, for your labor in general.
I think that kind of gets to like the experience of an induction, right? Yeah. And the way that that impacts a person going through it. Yeah. Not surprisingly, women's experiences of inductions of labor are super, super variable, right? Mm-hmm. There have actually been a fair amount of good quality qualitative studies that have looked at how people experience inductions of labor. And mm-hmm. a qualitative study, just as a bit of a backgrounder, is the type of study that looks at people's experiences and their perspectives in depth. So instead of looking yes. for things like numbers and statistics, it uses interviews and open-ended questions to understand the why and the how behind, you know, an occurrence. Yeah. And so it's a little bit of a different mode of study, but still one that has a lot of really, you know, clear-cut rules as to how to execute them in a way that allows us to really like rely on the answers that we're given.
Okay.
And so qualitative studies on this topic have consistently found that women really value clear communication, involvement mm-hmm. in decision-making, as well as compassionate support. And really mm-hmm. it's when these things are lacking that the induction is more likely to be perceived negatively, right? So mm-hmm. as I think we kind of talked about way back at the beginning of part one, but I think that the kernel of truth in all of this and the unifying thing, I think, amongst all of the varied experiences of inductions, is that clear conversations and, you know, well-presented information and a collaborative feel between providers and yeah. patients and family members really can make the difference between how people perceive their experience, irrespective of the outcome of the induction.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people go into inductions and even labor too, just natural labor mm-hmm. in general, with potentially unrealistic expectations that, you know, the timeline is going to be really quick and it's not. It's usually quite long. So having, you know, setting those realistic timelines ahead of time and, mm-hmm. you know, being prepared. That's another great thing is just having, like, if your OB has said an induction's most likely what's going to be happening for you, go home, do a little bit of research. Like there's so many people's experiences online. You can read a little bit if you want. If that's going to scare mm-hmm. you, don't do it. But because that's also potential, but you can prep mm-hmm. and just see a little bit of like, or even just ask them in the office, how long, like what can I realistically plan for how long this is going to take? And that'll help you to prepare your brain for what's lying ahead. And then also just like, remember to bring stuff with you, like distraction techniques. So I've seen so many patients bring like card games and I love that.
Sydney, what would you recommend people bring for the induction? Like we've talked about all of the mindset things, right? Like
yes.
be realistic in the timelines, know that you're going to be like, this is a hours to days long process, sometimes not, you know, minutes yeah. to hours.
Yeah.
We've talked about like support both from like your partners as well as from your care team. But what fun things can people bring to make the induction experience feel better to them?
Yeah, I would bring headphones, like 100% headphones, or a little speaker if you want. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I would prefer having headphones so that I can like get into like my own little zone and watch either watch something like a TV show that you're watching or a movie, or have music playing, listen to a podcast. Literally any distraction techniques is always my number one go-to. But think about, I almost think of inductions like going to the airport. That's a great analogy. Yeah. So if you're getting ready to go in for your induction, pack like you're going to go to the airport, because when you go to the airport, what are you doing? You're sitting around and you're waiting a lot of the time, right? And usually you have your laptop and you either answer emails or you watch a movie with your friend who you're traveling with, or you listen to your music, your podcast that you've downloaded ahead of time. And guys, I will say, download the Netflix episodes ahead of time, because the Wi-Fi at the hospitals.
Oh, atrocious.
Terrible, terrible. So, and sometimes there's even service issues, so you won't even be able to use your data. So down, like literally like you're going to be getting on an airplane, pack everything like you would be going on an airplane. So technology is great. We love technology, but snacks too. Pack a lot of snacks, because when you're waiting around, you're hungry and you don't want to be bored and hungry. That's just not a good combination. Mm-hmm. So that would be my best tip. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Apologies to anybody watching on the YouTube as I'm like, waiting.
Talking. I'm just gonna let her suffer over there.
For the social media shorts, you can cut out my face. I'm like desperately trying to hold in a throat tickle right now.
I know. We're almost done. She's been talking for an hour, so
Sydney was on such a roll, and everything she was saying was so good, and I didn't want to interrupt with a cough.
Oh man, it's okay. It's okay. Listen, we will film even when we're feeling sick. This is like the second or third time we've tried to film this episode this week too. So poor Megan's like, I can't cancel because I'm sick.
I know. But listen, I think we've made it to this episode's
now. Let me. I'm gonna conclude for her, because her poor voice. So
my voice has reached its end for this episode, guys.
It has. It's said some amazing things, though, some amazing points. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I hope it was able to give you, you know, some information and hopefully some facts about Pitocin and oxytocin and artificial rupture membranes, all that good stuff. I know inductions can be scary and a lot of people want to avoid them at all costs. I see that all the time, but we're here to tell you that, you know, we've seen some lovely inductions with our patients, and it's not necessarily the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. There's a lot of good evidence to show that they're safe, they're effective, and that they're a great tool to have. So I think inductions are, you know, in the right context, they can be really, really beneficial. So
There's nothing inherently good or bad about an induction.
Yep. Yeah.
And most of the time as well, I would hazard a guess that if this was not your plan and not what you wanted from your delivery, it is something that's being recommended to you for a medical reason. Yes. And while we will always be the people to stand in your corner and advocate for good information being presented to you and a good understanding of why something is being recommended, I think at the end of the day as well, keeping in mind that an induction can still be a really beautiful birthing experience. And that mindset and adequate support and ensuring good communication with your team are things that are not just, you know, intuitively good, but they are evidence-based for improving someone's overall perspective on an induction and on the delivery process as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I echo everything you said. And I'm going to just put it out there. I actually love my patients who come in for inductions, because it gives me a chance to like get to know them and chat with them before they're in pain too, before they, you know, we're far along in the laboring process. And I love getting to work and knowing that I have a patient coming in and I can go through all their history before they even get there. And then I sit down and I chat with them for like an hour. I actually love it, because I find it so stress-free and just relaxing.
Oh, there's a reason that so many OBs, myself included, have elective inductions, right?
Yeah.
I mean, mine was elective in part because of, you know, Sam being a giant, But
yes, he was big. I was going to say it was LGA. Yeah.
I was planning on having my 39-week arrive trial elective induction
even long before
I knew that I was growing a giant baby.
Yep.
And so that doesn't mean, but again, like the ground I will stand on so firmly with the arrive trial, this excellently constructed study, is that it does not suggest that everyone should have an induction. And nor am I doing that now, even sitting here telling you that this would have been my chosen delivery method, even if it hadn't been recommended to me towards the end.
Yes.
But I hope that knowing that those of us who do this every day, who walk patients through this course so frequently, would choose this for ourselves and our own children without fear. I just would hope that for somebody who is navigating this road and in a path that is unexpected to them, and where there's a lot of unknown and a lot of fear and uncertainty, I hope that that offers you some comfort in trying to navigate that. Right? Is that if we would choose it for ourselves, then we are comfortable and confident walking you through that choice as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on that note, you guys can follow us on Instagram, TikTok at the.push.podcast. We post all kinds of little clips and educational content for you there. So make sure you go follow and subscribe to us on YouTube as well if you haven't already. And we will be back next week with a new episode of the Push Podcast. Bye,
everyone. And I will have a voice.
And hopefully the Jays won.
Fingers crossed. Sorry, Dodgers fans.
Yeah.
Bye, everybody. Bye.